entire rotten lives scheming and conniving. Nonetheless, she wasn't some piss-your-pants pessimist. The fear that now and then shook a shudder from her was tempered by this electrifying current of delight in the prospect of seeing sudden justice done to these hateful thugs. She hoped this didn't mean that she was going to grow up to be one of those thrill-seekers who couldn't be happy unless they were skydiving or walking a tightrope between skyscrapers or wrestling alligators. Lori wanted to ride horses and become a veterinarian and marry Ethan Stackpool and have maybe 4 children. Children and alligators were not a good combination. When 2 sets of headlights, one close behind the other, turned off the state route and onto the entrance lane to Longren Stables, the first of a freaking parade of righteous firemen and firewomen, the thrill of delight swelled strong in Lori and nearly washed away her fear. She licked her split lip, which had earlier been bleeding after the dern beast slapped her, and she thought, "Kiss your own ass, Janice." One thing Lori didn't need to be told about life was that from time to time, everyone was met with disappointments, setbacks that tested your character and made you stronger if you kept your spine stiff and soldiered onward. She knew that, of course, but in her excitement she had forgotten about disappointments and had mistaken this one for triumph. Neither of the SUVs that raced along the lane was driven by Mr. Linwood Haney or by any of his friends. They were black Suburbans, and the woman standing guard down there, the one named Sally Jones, recognized these newcomers and waved them past the Cadillac Escalade that partially blocked entrance. These were the 6 additional bad hats who, as Chris Pervert had told Janice in the hallway, were going to do sharp elbow one-on-one interviews with the employees, scare the spunk out of them before sending them home. Then no one would be here but Lori, her sisters, her mom and dad, and 12 of them with their guns and their needles and their brain implants. She stared hard into the darkness, where she knew the state route ran north and south, but there were no other headlights, no rescuers imminent. Suddenly, she realized that she didn't have the scissors with which she'd cut the zip ties and freed herself. She couldn't remember where she might have put them down on the way from her bedroom to the fire watch. The scissors had been her only weapon. Chapter 8. When Radley DuBose returns to the kitchen, Minette Butterworth, wrung hard by emotion, is a swollen-faced, red-eyed faucet of grief with an apparently inexhaustible reservoir of tears. Behind the duct tape, when she's not making ba-ba noises like a bleeding sheep, she sounds as if she's choking on her grief, swallowing her tongue. Carter Jurgen finds the woman repellent. Excessive displays of emotion are not only undignified, but are always, in his opinion, as phony as a politician's promise, a display to draw attention to the wailer and elicit from others either sympathy for her suffering or admiration for the depth of her feeling. The husband, Robert, is beyond tears, and, he would have them believe, beyond fear as well. His eyes shine with the pure primal hatred of a maddened ape. He shouts his rage to no effect behind the swath of duct tape. He strains against his bonds and rocks the chair in which he sits. DuBose regards this pair not with disdain, as does Jurgen, but as if he is in some zoo, standing before an exhibit of 2 exotic animals whose droll appearance and antics he would like to have explained to him by a docent. His interest is short-lived, and he turns to address Ahmed, Malcolm, and the lovely Zita.
"That should have been an easy call, people. In the utopia that technology is making possible for those of us who control it, do you think we ought to encourage continued production of software that's 4 generations old? Why, for sentimental reasons? Should we maybe keep useless workers on a warehouse payroll just so they can watch the robots do the job more efficiently after the place has been automated?"
Ahmed and Malcolm look abashed, though it's difficult to tell whether they are embarrassed by their own failure to act according to Arcadian principles, or are disturbed by DuBose's comparisons of outdated software and displaced workers to Glynnis. DuBose continues,
For those who don't belong with us inside this scientific revolution, utilitarian bioethics must always apply. Society can't waste resources on those millions among the masses who receive far more than they'll ever produce. Such profligate spending has collapsed other civilizations.
The lovely Zita wishes to contribute. Besides, she says, it's a matter of compassion, quality of life. It's cruel to force people who can never be whole to live in diminished circumstances.
Exactly,
DuBose agrees.
We can stop those with diminished capacities from ever being born, but we also have to show the same compassion to those who, born whole, are later broken in one way or another.
Dismayingly, Zita Hernandez is now looking at the hillbilly philosopher with undeniable erotic interest. In fact, with greater intensity than that with which earlier she had seemed to regard Carter Jergen.
For the record, says DuBose, Jane Hawke attempted to take refuge in this house, and for whatever psychotic reason, she shot Glynnis to death.
Ahmed, Malcolm, and Zita all seem to be good with that. When their control mechanisms are in place, Minette and Robert will forget what they are told to forget, and will remember whatever scenario is described to them. DuBose lifts his chin, striking a noble pose, and says,
"Carry on, people,"
as if he is some great general bucking up the troops, or a wise and inspiring statesman equal to Churchill. He leads Jergen out of the dismal house, into a night of flying beetles and beetle-eating bats, into the astringent smell of coyote urine rising from the surrounding stonescape. In the near distance, the pack of urinators, now on the hunt, issue shrill and eerie cries, as if so maddened by the scent of prey that they must spill its blood at once, or else, in a frenzy, tear themselves apart. DuBose drives. Although Jergen often finds his partner lacking in manners, crude, and a social embarrassment, he admires DuBose's ruthlessness and implacable intent. "You shot her 3 times, he says, as DuBose wheels the velociraptor away from the house.
"Yeah?"
"One point-blank hollow point didn't kill her?"
"Put it in her chest. She was stone dead."
"Then why 2 more?
"Didn't like her expression."
"What about it?"
"She didn't look dead enough. Just sort of sneering. Smug."
"Well, she worked at the State Department," Jergen reminds him.
"Yeah, we know the type."
"So the other 2 shots?
"In the face."
"Do the trick?"
"She looks more dead now."
Chapter 9. Janice Dern is keeping her rage in check. No need for an anger management class. No need to take a time out in the corner without speaking privileges. No need to be sent off to bed without dessert while Francine and her 2 sibling cohorts get extra large portions of cake, thanks to Daddy's blindness to the meanness with which his precious favorite, Francine, and her 2 sibling toadies treat their youngest sibling. No need for anything now, except a little tough love directed at one freckle-faced, smart-mouthed tomboy, a little necessary discipline. The 6 additional agents have arrived from Austin. They're at Stable 2, giving the detained Longren employees a few lessons in respect for authority before sending them home. They have brought a MedExpress carrier containing 4 control mechanisms, one for Chase Longren, one for Alexis, and 2 more. Just in case. Once the Longrens have been injected, once nanowebs have spun securely across the surfaces and into the crevices of their brains, they'll give up Ansel and Claire's whereabouts. Let the others worry about Ansel and Claire. Janice has a project of her own. Although the house and stables have been searched, Lori Longren hasn't yet been found. The consensus is that the girl went overland, intending to intersect the state highway and flag down a motorist. The others, who seem swept up in magical thinking, believe she'll either conveniently step on a rattlesnake or be chased down by coyotes before she can get to help. Janice pities the rattlesnakes and coyotes that try to take a bite of that poisonous little bitch. Pedro Lobo has come over from stable two and is in the kitchen guarding Alexis, while Chris Roberts is cruising the state highway looking for the girl, hoping she'll mistake him for a civilian and seek his aid. Janice doesn't buy into the consensus. The brat isn't just smart-mouthed, she's also smart. She would never go blundering into the dark, wild fields without a light, with no better plan than hoping to flag down a motorist on a lonely road long past midnight. Her very nature is to be sand in the gears, a clog in the pipe, a monkey wrench in the machinery. She's likely to hang around the property, as quiet and quick as a rat in shadows, looking for the best way to disrupt things. The phone intercom units in the stables have been unplugged and locked away. If the girl fled the house, not just her room, when she went through the window onto the veranda roof, she's probably hoping to sneak back inside just long enough to use a phone. The doors are locked. The windows are now secured on both the first and second floors. However, she might know where a spare key is hidden, or might have a key of her own. Or she might have left the house by one window and at once returned to it by another, aware of some hidey-hole where she could wait out a search undiscovered. No one but Janice takes this theory seriously. Lori is a child, they say. They argue that a frightened child would not flee a place of terror only to return to it a moment later. But the child might do that very thing if she's something of a terror herself, has never been punished for her bad behavior, has never learned there are negative consequences because her scheming and trickery are rewarded by her ignorant, deluded father. Earlier, Paloma Sutherland, who is guarding Lori's younger sisters, had searched the upstairs while Sally Jones and Chris and Janice had hunted for the girl downstairs, around the house, in the garage, and in the stables. Now Janice explores the ground floor and the second floor as though she's looking for a child half Lori's size, as if the girl must be a contortionist who can fold herself into the most unlikely spaces, in the very back of every closet, behind the solid doors in the bottom third of a china cabinet that features glass doors above, under furniture with even as little as a 4-inch clearance, behind the fire screen, in the inner hearth of a fireplace. Wherever there is paneling on an inner wall, she seeks hidden latch releases that might reveal a safe or other secret space. In the master bedroom, her attention is drawn to an incongruous object lying on the white quartz top of a mahogany pedestal dresser. Arranged just so are an antique silver tray that holds 3 Lalique perfume bottles with figured crystal stoppers, an antique silver brush and comb set, and 3 small porcelain figurines of Japanese women in intricately colored kimonos. Lying askew to everything else is a pair of cheap scissors with orange plastic handles. The girl must have cut the zip ties with scissors taken from her desk drawer, but no scissors remain in her room. Maybe she took them for self-defense. Evidently, Paloma Sutherland never noticed the discordant scissors among all the pretties on the dresser. Janice stares into the mother's dresser mirror as though she possesses the clairvoyant power to see her quarry's reflection when the room was dark and the girl paused here and, for some reason, put down the scissors. The ensuite bathroom offers no hiding place. When Janice opens the door to the walk-in closet and turns on the light, Lori isn't crouched in any corner of that space. From the ceiling dangles a pull cord attached to one end of a trap door. Paloma is the most adamant of those who believe that the girl would not have returned to the house a moment after having fled it. When she searched here, she would not have thought the attic was worth exploring. An only child, Paloma has no understanding whatsoever of the capacity for boldness and deceit of the oldest sister in a family of sisters. The heavy springs of the ceiling trapdoor briefly groan, but the ladder unfolds to the closet floor with hardly a sound. Chapter 10. Although Carter Jurgen is growing accustomed to grotesque sights, he is taken aback when two large, hairy spiders, he assumes they are tarantulas, shudder out of the dark and into a swath of bare earth illuminated by the headlamps of the Velociraptor, where it is parked alongside the airstrip. At first, it appears that the hideous arachnids are proceeding in tandem, the second close behind the first, but that's because, in the harsh angled light, it is initially difficult to differentiate between their busy limbs and the elongated, twitching shadows of their limbs. In fact, the second spider seems to be climbing onto the first, as if to ride it to whatever work spiders undertake at night. The first tarantula appears displeased and impatient with this impertinence, trying to shrug off the lazy, unwanted passenger. Their legs, each the size of one of Jurgen's fingers, jitter and clash, so that they stagger this way and that, proceeding in such a herky-jerky fashion that they make no progress at all, but instead circle back into the darkness out of which they emerged. On any other night, the Anza Airpark would be closed. It allows only daylight takeoffs and landings. Monday morning, however, the National Security Agency negotiated a rich 5-day contract, ostensibly to do emergency testing of an unspecified type of airborne day and night communications equipment in desert conditions, without interfering with the facility's usual business. In fact, they will mount continuous visual surveillance of the valley while fishing from the air, within a 50-mile radius, all conversations conducted on carrier waves assigned to disposable phones. Using an analytic scanning program customized to key words that Jane Hawk might use when speaking to her son, or to whoever was currently watching over the boy, a computer aboard the aircraft can read conversations almost as fast as they are intercepted. When a suspect conversation is identified, that transmission can be tracked to its source and the location of the phone quickly pinpointed. The NSA maintains such aircraft in major cities thought to be likely targets of terrorism. One has been flown here from San Diego, another from Los Angeles, and they stand now on a taxiway. The airplanes are de Havilland DHC-6 Twin Otters with two turboprop engines. The longest runway at this desert airstrip is 2,600 feet, but the Twin Otter needs only 1,200 to take off, even less to land. In a standard configuration, in addition to a crew of two, the craft carries 19 passengers. Customized for this unique form of surveillance, the passenger compartment provides for only 4 technicians and their equipment. A tanker truck stands on a hastily poured pad of quick-cure concrete adjacent to the taxiway where the aircraft wait. It contains sufficient aviation fuel to keep the Twin Otters, which will work in 4-hour shifts, in the air around the clock for 3 days. 4 aircraft mechanics, complete with their equipment, have been brought to the site in a 60-foot motorhome parked adjacent to the Anza Airpark terminal. It is their home for the duration, and it also houses the tanker truck driver and a pump technician. In addition, there is an Airbus H-120 helicopter with pilot and co-pilot to provide aerial search and surveillance as needed. Men are currently placing portable marker lights along both sides of the runway, one every 10 feet. The markers are battery-powered and can be turned on remotely when one of the de Havillands is coming in for a night landing, then switched off when the plane is safely down. The proprietors of the airpark must be pleased with the value of the contract they received, but they must also be dazzled, or at least surprised, by the size of this operation. Maybe they wonder why such testing couldn't have been conducted on one of the many military bases situated in desert terrain. Wise men and women, however, know what questions should not be asked, and these days, the words, "you don't want to know," are an ever more common American catchphrase. Radley Dubose, who has been talking to the runway lighting crew, returns now to the Velociraptor.
"They'll be done in 3 hours. We'll have an otter in the air by 7 in the morning."
as though this desert possesses consciousness, knows how Jurgen detests it, and therefore resolves to inflame his disgust at every opportunity, it now sends the two tarantulas skittering out of the shadows once more, but this time locked in more furious combat. The ridden spider stilts erratically on its hairy legs, rushing forward, then circling in place, twitching, furious, frenzied. The bedeviled creature flings itself onto its back, whereupon it and the rider flail their ghastly legs at each other, their repulsive bodies paled by dust as fine as talcum powder. They erupt apart and onto their feet, face to face, and strain to their full height, on point and legs quivering with tension, so that it seems one or the other will now deliver a lethal bite. Then they relax, and side by side, scurry away into the darkness once more.
What the hell was that all about? Jurgen wonders. Romance, says Dubose. My friend, if you can't recognize passion when you see it, too damn much time has passed since you were last in the saddle.
Chapter 11. Like some cold haunt that has crossed over from the world of the dead, Janice Dern drifts through pools of shadow and amber light under a series of conical lamps attached to the central roof beam, raising not one squeak from the plywood underfoot. Stacked 6 to 7 feet high, boxes wall the main north-south aisle, except where shadowed passageways intersect from the west and east. In air scented with dust and aging cardboard, the shredded webs of dead spiders hang from the rafters and quiver in a draft, like the gray and tattered flags of forgotten nations. And scattered on the floor are bright flecks of Christmas ornament glitter, sparkling red, green, gold, and silver. Janice keeps her right hand on the pistol in her belt holster. If the tomboy initially took the scissors with her to use them for self-defense, perhaps she'd left them on the dresser because she had since acquired a better weapon. She might have taken a handgun from one of the nightstands flanking her parents' bed. She is not yet 13, a child who should fear firearms and who should certainly have had no training in their use. However, these days there are a great many irresponsible parents, and it is possible that the snarky little bitch knows how to stand, hold, and aim to compensate for recoil. At first, Janice approaches every intersection with exaggerated caution, until she recognizes that ahead of her an open set of steel stairs spirals up to some higher redoubt. She knows at once that the girl has gone there, that this is why the brat didn't flee the house for the cover of the night outside. The upper room, whatever it might be, provides something that the brat wants. Some advantage, some weapon, some... Oh, shit, she says. A phone! No longer concerned that the tomboy is armed and lying in wait among the stacks of boxes, Janice hurries to the stairs and ascends the tight spirals like a bullet speeding through a rifled barrel. At the top is a small room of windowed walls, offering a 360-degree view of the night, a phone on a shelf between two windows, but no girl. Suddenly, a great turbulence of sound and wind arises, the many panes thrumming and, where loosely fit, rattling in their frames. Dust and chaff and dead leaves and shingle splinters are swept off the surrounding roof of the house to flail the windows as though some pestilential swarm has come out of the deep prairie night. A fierce, bright shaft stabs down and sweeps across the glass, flooding the high redoubt with light and with the shadows of mullions and muntins that distort and twist their way around the room as they are harried by the passage of the beam. Janice stands astonished, pierced by a sense of the uncanny, but this disturbance of the mind and heart lasts only a moment before she realizes that a helicopter has come down fast out of the night. Following her realization, the craft appears behind the searchlight, clearing the roof by no more than 20 feet to hover above the escalade that blocks the entry lane. Spotlighted, Sally Jones looks up and waves at the helo, as though she assumes it represents some additional support about which she hasn't been told.
The little bitch tomboy, the deceitful, smart-ass, sure-to-be-one-day whore, used the phone here, called in someone. Not the county sheriff. There's no law enforcement designation on the Hilo. Whoever these bastards are, they believe what bullshit the snot-eating geek told them, so they come roaring in like a brigade of Texas Rangers. This is shaping up to be another version of the fiasco at the Hawks Ranch on Sunday night, when that son of a bitch Juan Saba, the ranch manager, stood them off. Abruptly, Jane remembers that she told Lori Longren about the brain implants, in some detail. The injections, the nanoconstructs, how they penetrate the blood-brain barrier, how they assemble into a web across and into the tissue of the brain. All that is something Jane Hawke clearly knows, but it's not something that anyone in the conspiracy is authorized to reveal to others. Janice wanted to terrorize the freckle-faced, potato-sucking piglet, and she figured to get hold of a control mechanism later and inject the little rat, or, failing that, to lobby Egon Gottfried to have the injected parents eventually kill the children and then themselves, so that what she revealed to Lori wouldn't matter. Now, it matters. She needs to find the girl. Quick. Chapter 12. The dark Texas plain, infinite in appearance. The sky overhead, infinite in fact. Chris Roberts in his radically hot, bespoke Range Rover by Overfinch North America. On top of the world, an insider in the most powerful cabal of insiders in all history. Techno-Arcadian fighter for utopia. One of the rulers of the ruled, destined to live forever, infinite, eternal. If medical technology progresses as it has done in recent years, Puff Daddy on the CD deck, so hard-ass cool. Chris singing along with Puff Daddy like he did when he was 13 so long ago. Puff Daddy and Faith Evans, so hot, pure sex. Thinking about shacking up with Janice Dern for a torrid week. He is cruising back and forth on the two-lane state highway, all that lonely blacktop to himself at this late hour. He hopes the Longren kid will appear on the shoulder of the road, but thus far she remains missing. His attention is drawn to the running lights of a helicopter approaching from out of the northwest. In even small cities these days, policing is done by air as well as on the streets. And the sight of an airborne patrol spotlighting a fleeing fugitive's car as it races recklessly along a freeway is common stuff on the evening news. In the hinterlands like this, however, the skies are usually quiet at night. Chris intuits trouble in this aerial apparition. The chopper crosses the highway ahead of him on a trajectory that will take it directly to Longren Stables. At an altitude of maybe 300 feet, in the dark, any identification that might be on the aircraft can't be seen. When he returns his attention to the road, oncoming headlamps have materialized. They quickly grow larger, brighter, issuing from the direction of Worstead. In a moment, he can see it's not just one vehicle, but a caravan. They flash past him like a pack of NASCAR competitors in a tight formation toward the finish line. 2, 3, 5... 7, 9, 10, 11 vehicles, mostly pickups and SUVs, a couple cars. The timing of the helicopter and the cars isn't coincidental, and there aren't that many places they could be going in this empty country. At this hour, at their speed, the only place they can be headed is Longren Stables. No more oncoming headlamps appear. Chris brakes, hangs a hard U-turn, and switches off the music. By the time he reaches the Longren property, the 11 cars are parked along the private entrance lane, this side of the blocking escalade, where Sally Jones and a few new agents from Austin engage in a confrontation with a crowd of local men and women. Chris parks athwart the lane to prevent an easy exit by this self-appointed posse. He gets out of the Range Rover and moves toward the crowd, his right hand on the pistol in his belt holster. Chapter 13. In the attic, at the end of one of the rows of stored goods, Lori Longren knelt with her back pressed against the stacked boxes, out of sight of the main aisle.
She'd wanted to remain in the fire watch until Mr. Linwood Haney arrived with other firefighters and the threat posed by the Federal Bureau of Evil Idiots had come to an end. But when the six agents from Austin arrived first, she was kind of spooked. And when she realized that she didn't have the scissors with which to defend herself, a sense of helplessness overcame her. All the windows in the fire watch made her feel naked and vulnerable, though as long as she stayed low, no one on the ground below could see her. Then she realized where she must have put down the scissors. On her mother's dresser, just before moving to the walk-in closet. She decided to go back and get them and return to the fire watch. Feeling her way in the dark, she'd been almost to the trapdoor when someone pulled it open from below. Closet light rose into the attic, and the ladder unfolded to accommodate whoever might be coming up. Lori had hurried back toward the spiral staircase, but then realized the fire watch would be a trap. So she came to the end of this row of boxes and knelt there, a narrow aisle to either side of her, but hidden from anyone in the main passageway. No sooner had she gotten out of sight than the lights had come on. She strained to hear footsteps, detected none. Then the voice of the Janus beast broke the silence. Oh, shit! A phone! And the woman was so close that Lori almost cried out, for an instant certain that Janus saw her and was speaking directly to her. Then there were hurried footsteps, and it seemed as though the sulfur-eyed Queen of Hell must be climbing the spiral stairs into the fire watch. Lori considered easing out of her refuge and hurrying to the trap door and down the ladder to hide somewhere below where they had already searched. Just as she was about to get off her knees, however, the very skeleton of the big attic, roof sheeting, rafters, collar beams, outriggers, studs, vibrated as hard, rhythmic blasts of sound slammed through it. Gusts of wind hissed as they strained through the fine wire screens over the ventilation cutouts in the eaves, blowing dust off the boxes, tearing the raggedy webs of long-dead spiders from their moorings and billowing them past her like eerie sea anemones, pinching her nose shut against the tickling dust, breathing through her mouth to avoid sneezing. She stayed on her knees half a minute until she realized that the source of the uproar must be a helicopter, first passing over the house and now hovering near it, whereupon she sprang to her feet in excitement. Mr. Glenn Aylkirk, a local volunteer fireman and once a helo jockey in the Navy, owned a four-seat Robinson R-44 Raven, with which he surveyed field conditions on his large ranch, made day trips to Austin and San Antonio, and visited in-laws in Uvalde. If this was Mr. Aylkirk, the firemen and firewomen were coming with a dramatic display of force, and Lori was no longer at risk of becoming the puppet and pet of crazy Janus. She almost stepped into the aisle to her left, but then she realized that her tormentor, having found the fire watch deserted and probably startled by the arrival of the helicopter, would head back to the trap door and the ladder. With all the racket, Lori couldn't be sure where the woman might be. Better to hunker down and wait a few minutes. She sat on the floor with her back to the boxes. The helo kept chugging nearby. She knew that everything would be all right soon. Very soon. Yet her stomach still fluttered. Her heart knocked hard like a fist on a door. The sound of the rotary wing chopping the night air, which had at first been scary and then had been reassuring, began to seem scary again. Chapter 14. The chopper noise like the sound made all those years ago when, time and again, Francine had knocked Janus down and knelt on her chest and boxed both her ears with the flat palms of her hands. Until Janus couldn't think straight, and the headache came, and then tinnitus that continued for hours after the assault concluded. The spiral staircase is like some churning drill bit, so that Janus feels less like she's descending than like she's caught up in the bore and being pulled down, each step like a cutting nub on the shank of a bit, her feet skidding from step to step in spite of the rubber treads, the cold railing vibrating under her hand, the whole construction seeming to turn around her with carnival ride frenzy. At the bottom, feet on the attic floor, she stands for a moment, swaying, dizzy, the chopper noise drilling fear into her, although she had thought herself long past fear. The unceasing clatter isn't just the sound of this operation at Longren Stables falling apart, but seems also to be the crack and clatter of her future collapsing. She has screwed up with the little bitch tomboy, let her get away, gave her a chance to call for help, and a mistake of this magnitude does not result in just a slap on the wrist or a boxing of the ears. Arcadian discipline is swift and severe, which it must be to keep a secret like the nano-implants from being leaked. If a failure is judged damaging enough to the revolution, then her future will be sealed with a needle, a catheter, and the infusion of 3 ampules of cloudy amber fluid. Thereafter, she will do what she's told to do, be what she is told to be, ever submissive. Perhaps she'll be given to some disgusting Arcadian techno-geek to be sexually used and humiliated and physically abused until she ages 10 years in one, then strangled and bagged like garbage and thrown away. Her dizziness doesn't entirely pass, but she begins to move anyway. She's got to find the devious little shit. Find her and bind her. There is a way to use the brat to fix this situation. There must be a way. The problem is locating the mocking midget bitch in time. Whatever chaos the helicopter brings with it, if a mob is here in the numbers that came out of Juan Saba's house, the girl can't be allowed to escape among them. Halfway between the spiral staircase and the trap door, several inches within one of the side aisles, lies a spider. Once fat and juicy, it is now deformed in a wet blot of what once had been its internal substance. Recently tramped on. Janice has never stepped foot in any of the side aisles. She has proceeded to and from the spiral stairs using the main aisle. It can't be Janice who stepped on the spider. And the glistening ichor in which it lies attests to the truth that it hasn't been dead for days. Her attention seems to have been drawn to the squashed spider by some supernatural power. For it is but a dark blot on the light plywood, and could be so easily overlooked. She stands, transfixed, trembling, as the structure around her is trembled by the fwa, 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 fwa. Chapter 15. The confrontation at the Cadillac Escalade, where Sally Jones and 3 of the agents from Austin face a crowd of maybe 30 people, is not good. Chris Roberts judges the situation to have a low flashpoint. The helicopter moves off a little, hovering over the fenced exercise yard, but it is still loud enough to require those engaged in this tense dialogue to raise their voices. They are shouting back and forth. The volume of the conversation only fuels an expectation of violence. The helo's searchlight is trained on the 4 agents, a crisp white beam that pales them and carves their faces with stark shadows, giving them an ominous aspect that only further unnerves the mob. Sally and 2 men from Austin are flashing FBI credentials, making a case for their authority. But the locals, men and women, are not impressed and are in no mood to back down. They want to see arrest warrants, search warrants, which they have no right to see because this doesn't have anything to do with them. The most troubling thing is the name they keep citing. Jane. Jane Hawk. Jane. Jane. Jane Hawk. Because they understand this has something to do with her, with her in-laws, and with the fact that Chase Longren and the late Nick Hawk were once best friends. They don't speak of Jane Hawk as though she's a traitor to her country and a threat to national security. Not as if she's a murderer, but as if she's a victim of slander and libel. Indeed, more concerning to Chris is that some of these people speak of her not just with the affection that she might earn merely by being one of their own, but with admiration and even veneration. It's as if, by foiling the entire apparatus of the all-powerful state that's been pursuing her for months, she has ascended to the mystical status of a folk hero. They demand to see Chase and Alexis and the children. They want to know why the employees are being held. They have no right to see anyone or have any questions answered, and they surely know as much. They are intruders here, They are being told they're engaged in the obstruction of justice, but they aren't going to go away. This is quickly becoming a standoff that may go on for days, unless it becomes something worse. The youngest of the Austin agents doesn't bother to shake his badge at the angry crowd. He draws his pistol, holding it against his chest, as if pledging allegiance to it, which is foolish and likely to inflame passions. Some of the people in the crowd are openly armed, but their weapons are in their holsters. Those who don't obviously carry firearms might have them concealed. In this atmosphere, brandishing a gun is like striking a match in the dark to find the source of a gas leak. Chris Roberts works his way around the mob toward the wet-behind-the-ears agent to tell him to get a grip and put the gun away. After all, they are operating far beyond the limits of the law, by the rules of a thugocracy, the Constitution be damned, and there are risks to that approach. They have friends in high places, yes, and judges who will protect them, yes, and friends in the media who will do their best to bury an embarrassing story, but maybe not if a shootout results in a lot of people dead and others wounded. Chapter 16. Lori Longren thought maybe it was safe to move. If the Janus monster had not by now gone downstairs and outside to meet whatever contingent of firemen and firewomen had arrived, then surely she'd gone back to the Black Lagoon or Transylvania or to whatever hole in the ground she called home. Rising once more to her feet, her back pressed to the stacked cartons at Rose End, she took a deep breath, held it, listened. The helicopter moved off a little way, and the attic no longer trembled under it, but the noise from its engine and rotary wing remained loud enough to mask most other sounds. She didn't want to hide like this. She felt childish and weak. She hadn't been born to hide from trouble. Daddy said you couldn't hide from trouble anyway, that the trouble you were hiding from would find you sooner or later, and while you were hiding from it, the trouble was getting bigger. So that when it finally found you, it was harder to deal with than if you'd just faced up to it in the first place. So she turned to her left and leaned forward and peered into the aisle. From a distance of less than 2 feet, she met the eyes of Janus Dern. Even beneath a veil of shadow, something about the woman's face was different from what it had been, distorted by terror or hatred or both. Like an early version of the human face before it was refined and the species was put into production. A faint trace of the amber attic light found its way into those fierce eyes, coloring them more yellow than usual, so that they appeared electrified and incandescent. Her voice was a vicious whisper. "My little pet." Before Lori could respond, the yellow-eyed freak jabbed her with something. Even through her t-shirt, she felt the two cold points of pressure. Buzzing, both sound and sensation, filled her from muscle to marrow, and disabling pain crackled across the soles of her feet and across her scalp and everywhere in between. She lost all control of her body and went to the floor as if her bones had melted in an instant. She heard herself making wordless sounds of distress as she spasmed like some fish hooked and reeled in and lying on a riverbank, forever beyond hope of water. Chapter 17. The sound softer now, though still bringing vividly to mind the torture of hands clapping her ears. The pressure of Francine's knees on her chest, her heart compressed as the breastbone bends under the weight. While the little whore is paralyzed, Janus sets aside the handheld taser and takes a bundle of zip ties from an inner pocket of her sport coat. She uses one tie to cuff the slut's hands. "You're gonna get what you deserve," she declares. "You're done. You're finished. You're gonna get just what you've always deserved." The girl recovers enough to kick out at her, trying for her face, landing a feeble blow on her shoulder. Infuriated, Janus snatches up the taser and jolts the little tart again, puts it right on her throat, and watches her face convulse and her eyes roll back in her head. She uses three more zip ties to fetter the girls' ankles to each other, allowing just enough play in those shackles for the brat to shuffle along, but not run. Chapter 18. Moths, abandoning the boring glow of house windows and driveway lampposts, drawn to the bright shaft, swirling up toward the source, as if the searchlight is a tractor beam that levitates them through the night and into some extraterrestrial vessel. As the crowd grows noisier and more insistent, Sally Jones is unable to placate them with reassurances of legal process, and the young agent from Austin doesn't want to put away his gun.
"Hell, look at them," he tells Chris Roberts. "They're not just a bunch of hick farmers, they're rough scuff, rabble, with an entire freaking gun store inventory among them, and they're photographing us with their phones." "All the more reason not to be photographed breaking bureau protocol and brandishing a gun. If the shit hits the fan and bullets fly, you want your face all over the internet?"
"The internet isn't the Wild West anymore," Chris says. "We've got laws. We've got a boot on it."
"Yeah, maybe, but we don't have a chokehold on it."
"We've also got high-placed friends on the private side," Chris insists. "Anything gets posted from this tonight, it'll be taken down within the hour, even quicker. They can make it so you Google Longren Stables and it's like the place never existed."
The young agent shakes his head, scanning the crowd for the first indication that the worst is about to happen.
"I don't like being photographed. Not here. Not like this. Don't like it at all."
Chapter 19. The obnoxious little slut doesn't want to get to her feet. She isn't cool with the way the tables have turned. She acts as though she's still disoriented, too loose-limbed to stand and walk. But it's just an act. Pretense. Deceit. She lives to deceive. She's the bitch queen of deception. Everything she ever says is a lie, and Janice doesn't buy a word of it.
"Get your ass in gear! Get on your feet!" Janice orders, looming over her. "Get up or I'll taser your hateful face! I'll make you bite on it, and I'll taser your lying tongue! You want to take a jolt through that dirty little tongue of yours?"
The threat works. The girl struggles to her feet and stands swaying. There's such contempt graven on her face, but when hasn't there been? That's among the primary identifying qualities of her type. Conceit, vanity, arrogance, and the never-ending contempt of one who sees herself above all others. The shuffling girl weaves along the central aisle, across oval pools of light and bridges of shadow, toward the trapdoor and the ladder, bumping against the walls of boxes, pretending still to be suffering residual effects of the taserings. By clambering to her feet after claiming that she could not, the little slut has proved her weakness is mere pretense. And yet she can't stop pretending, because guile and trickery are no less components of her blood than is plasma.
"Move! Move, damn you!" Janice orders, prodding the treacherous little whore.
Backing down the ladder, clutching the side rails, the girl hesitates to place each foot, as though her spatial awareness remains disrupted by the shocks she has taken. When the cunning little sleaze is halfway down, Janice follows, but she doesn't turn her back on her captive. She knows too well the danger of letting the bitch get behind her. Instead, she faces forward, perches on the trapdoor frame, and then sits from one step of the ladder to the next. Below Janice, three steps from the bottom, the girl looks up, hair hanging across her face, one eye revealed and bright with calculation. Before the hateful little weasel can try whatever trick she has conceived, Janice kicks out, booting her in the chest, knocking her backward onto the closet floor. Off the ladder, Janice grabs a fistful of the brat's t-shirt and yanks on it.
"Come on! Come on, you little shit! You'll never win an Oscar with a performance like this!"
She harries the girl to her feet, out of the closet door, into the master bedroom, and shoves her toward the door to the upstairs hallway. A girl such as this has a bottomless capacity for treachery, which she proves again when, shuffling past her mother's dresser, she grabs for the scissors that she left there earlier. Janice anticipates this rebellion. As her captive reaches for the weapon, she boots her in the backside. The foolish girl staggers forward and, trammeled by the zip ties, trips herself and falls to her knees. Janice sweeps the silver brush and comb set off the dresser onto the floor, and then the silver tray with the three small Lalique perfume bottles. She picks up one of the porcelain geishas with its colorful kimono and throws it at the girl. Then the second, the third. She snatches up the scissors. Get up, you little sleaze! Get up! Get up! I'm not going to be injected because of you. I won't be made a slave. Get up or I'll taser you until you swallow your tongue and choke to death on it. Chapter 20. Having locked the employees in Stable 2 with only Alejandro Lobo to look after them, the other three Austin agents step out of the darkness into the searchlight, bringing the number at the front line of the confrontation to 8, making a show of force that might dissuade the armed posse from pushing this too far. Chris Roberts hopes that one of the three has had the wit to call for additional backup. Even if more Arcadians are en route, however, the odds are they won't get here in time to stop these rednecks from doing something stupid. Sally Jones, thus far the only spokesperson for the government in this matter, understands the need to appear equal to the threat of the crowd. She shouts at the restive mob for quiet. 8 more of us inside the house, 4 in the stables, she lies. We came here in serious numbers because this damn well is an urgent matter of national security, whether you want to believe us or not. The future of our country is at stake. I know you're all patriots here. I know you want to do the right thing. Think before you do something you'll regret. Many of you probably have children at home. Think about them. You don't want to do anything that leaves those kids without a family. They need you.
Is that a threat? Shouts a man in the mob. You mean to shoot us down like we're animals?
Sally raises both hands in a gesture of placation.
No, 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 I'm saying we're engaged in legitimate law enforcement here. Anyone who interferes with us will have to be charged according to their offenses and prosecuted to the full extent of the law. There's no way around that. To the full extent of the law. Your babies back home will be without you for a long time. Doing prison, you'll stain yourself and them. Your family name, their reputation, all for what? All because you've been misinformed.
A man who previously identified himself as Linwood Haney, and who seems to be the leader of this rabble, speaks up.
Bring Chase and Alexis out here, them and their three girls, so we can ask them, is all this righteous police work, like you say?
We can't do that, Sally says. You don't understand. Chase and Alexis have agreed to cooperate with us in return for immunity. They're in the middle of giving depositions, under oath. It would compromise the integrity of the deposition process to interrupt the continuity of the recording, and that would jeopardize Chase and Alexis's immunity, which is the last thing they would want, believe me, the last thing.
Chris winces at this response to Haney. Sally talks down to the crowd as though she thinks their kind are as ignorant and clueless as the stereotypical hayseeds with which some in the media believe flyover country is entirely populated. Sure enough, a woman shouts an objection.
You saying their lawyers in there with them at this ungodly hour? Hell's bells, woman, their lawyer is Raleigh Capshaw. Old Raleigh goes to bed 8:30 every night, sure as the flag has stars and stripes. He won't stay up till 3 in the morning like this, even if he knows for a fact it's the night Jesus is coming back.
Among the crowd, there is considerable agreement with this assessment, and Linwood Haney says,
There won't be a damn thing righteous about any deposition taken without they're allowed a lawyer.
Chapter 21. The clatter of the helicopter is more muffled in the upstairs hallway than it had been in the attic, but as the deceitful little whore pretends that her fettered ankles require slow progress on the front stairs, and as Janice prods her to move faster toward the foyer below, the rhythmic pounding of the blades grows louder again. The sound echoes inside Janice's skull, and a headache grows, and the shells of her ears burn as if abused by the clapping hands of her vicious sister. And though she's standing up, she feels the weight of her long-ago tormentor on her chest. In the foyer, she jerks the girl around to face her and is satisfied to see stark fear instead of arrogance. You listen to me, you worthless little slut. Damn if I'm gonna have my brain spun up in a control web because of you. I'd as soon kill you as spit on you, so the time for trickery is over. It's over. I'm going to cut the zip ties, and I'm taking you out there on the porch, and you're going to tell these stupid shit kickers you were wrong to call them. Tell them you didn't understand what was really happening here. You're going to give the performance of a lifetime. And don't tell me you can't, because I know you're kind. You're just like her. Deceit is woven through your bones. Your tongue is a filthy, licking lie machine. You can be as bratty as you want and get away with it because of what you do for your daddy, like what she did for ours, the sleazy little whore. I know the truth. I saw them that one time, and I know you. You're going to stand close to me, lean against me like you feel safe with me, and I'm your best friend ever. Stay close so no one can see I'm holding you by the back of your belt. You're going to smile and charm and lie your ass off. You're going to send these shit kickers home, or I swear, I'll draw my gun and shoot you in the head, right there on the porch. Blow your rotten whore brains all over the damn porch. Chapter 22. Chris Roberts doesn't realize that Janice has come out of the house with the girl, Lori, until the helicopter co-pilot sweeps the bright beam away from the line of agents and splashes light across the front veranda. Disaster. Whatever the hell Janice thinks she's doing, it's going to end in disaster. Something's wrong with her. She's always ardent, intense, edgy. But this is not that Janice. This Janice is a human grenade with her pin half pulled. Her shoulders are drawn up, head turtled down. Her alluring body is shorn of curves by tension shaped into the crossed staves of a scarecrow. Her eyes appear sprung in their sockets, like those of some goggle-eyed jack-in-the-box. Her smile is a ghastly slash, and if her face contains any color, the searchlight bleaches it to the pallor of a corpse. The child beside Janice stares out from among wild tangles of disarranged hair. She stands with hands fisted at her sides. Her posture is that of a shocked ledge walker who missteps and is supported for a microsecond by thin air, who stands in the splinter of an instant between the end of the ledge and the beginning of the plunge. As one, every member of the crowd falls silent, and there is just the beating of the chopper's blades, like the tolling of a lead bell. Janice raises her voice.
Lori Longgren wants to apologize.
She punctuates her announcement with a smile like a sickle. Chapter 23. With her left hand, Janice Dern grips the little whore's belt, preventing her from making a break for the crowd. The thumb of her other hand is hooked on her own belt, at her right side, so that in an instant she can push her sport coat out of the way and draw the pistol from her hip holster. The searchlight shouldn't be either hot or cold. It's merely a light. But it makes the painted porch floor glisten like ice, and it chills Janice. It cuts at her eyes. She can't look directly at it. By the time she and the punk reach the porch steps and stop, the crowd of would-be rescuers falls silent. They stand, expectant, some with their mouths open, their faces as dull as those of cattle. They are all as common as dirt, and Janice can never be one of them, never has been, never will be. She has known herself to be above the ruck and rabble since she was 9, since the day she saw Francine on her knees, submissive and servicing that bastard in the way that he preferred, both of them as base as barnyard animals. In that instant, she knows she is not of their blood. The story of their family is a lie. Surely she was born to parents unknown, a husband and wife of the highest station, and soon after birth was kidnapped, sold into this squalid household for the use and amusement of base and cruel people. Shortly after seeing him with Francine, Janice is alone with their so-called father, and though he doesn't come on to her, She tells him that if she is in line behind her sisters to do what Francine does for him, she will bite it off. Bite off what she can and spit it out and bite off more. She doesn't belong in that family. She doesn't belong among these people here tonight, either. And she is too high-born ever to belong among the adjusted people who have in their heads a web of 1,000 filaments with which their betters manipulate them through the puppet theater of their lives. Now, she smiles at the girl beside her and smiles at these upturned faces. This duplicitous little bitch has the skill to deceive the finest lie detector. The brat better con these cretins and send them home to their beds, because if this crisis can't be smoothed away, there is a brain implant with the name Janice Dern on it. Janice will not tolerate being injected, reduced to the condition of property. At 30, she is perhaps too old and not sufficiently beautiful to be stocked in one of the aspasias, but she will not allow herself to be made property of any kind for any purpose. Aspasia is the name of the mistress of some famous mayor of Athens 2,400 years ago, and it is what they call the palatial, highly secret, membership-only brothels in Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and D.C., where the techno-Arcadians with the greatest wealth and power go to indulge their most extreme desires. Not common whorehouses, mansions of exquisite architecture, decorated with tens of millions of dollars worth of art, antiques, and furnishings. Palaces of style and refined taste that make it possible for the members of the club to tell themselves that their sickest and most degrading desires are in fact as elevated as the elegant environment. The girls are stunning, each one as beautiful as the most striking supermodels, each one a perfect daughter of Eros, totally submissive, ready to satisfy the most extreme desires. There is no demand they will refuse. Charming, seeming to be happier than angels, they live in Aspasia and never leave, never even have a desire to leave, not one passing impulse to be free. The injections administered to them are different from those used to make adjusted people. This ultimate nano-implant deletes every last one of the girl's memories, deletes her entire personality, and installs a new and much simpler one. She becomes a living toy. The process cannot be reversed. Who she was is gone forever. Janice has been in the Aspasia that is outside Washington, D.C. Because she is judged to be a fervid revolutionary, beyond all doubt devoted to the cause, she was allowed to go there as a guest of a man who is a member. The experience haunts her dreams and motivates her to rise in the hierarchy of Techno-Arcadia until she is beyond any risk of being punished with injection. Now, she smiles again at the girl beside her and again at the upturned faces of the rescuers, who seem almost to be a different species from her own. She says, "Lori Longren wants to apologize." The man who took her to the Washington Aspasia is a hugely successful entrepreneur, Gregory, with whom she conducts an intense on-again, off-again affair, which is one way that she ascends the Arcadian ladder. She had heard whispers of the brothels, rumors so vague they weren't credible. Sex with Greg is vigorous, interesting, and edgy. With sly amusement, he sometimes calls himself Jekyll and Hyde, but it turns out there is some truth in this. She had only seen Jekyll, and he wanted her to accompany Hyde to Aspasia, not to participate, but only to watch. Among other things, Gregory is an exhibitionist, and he felt that it would be interesting if, when Janice is in the future bedded with Jekyll, she would have in her mind the threat of Hyde. That night at Aspasia, for more than 4 hours, Gregory indulged in a demonic catalogue of depravities. He subjected the Aspasia girl, who had but a single name, Flavia, to degradations of which Janice never previously conceived. He didn't stab Flavia to death at the moment.